Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, and welcome back to Talking Companies. I'm Phil Muscatello.
And I'm Mark Tobin.
And today we're focusing on Brickworks Limited, ASX code BKW. Brickworks was established in 1934, listed on the Australian Stock Exchange in 1961, and has been led by Lindsay Partridge AM for the past 35 years. And he's overseen incredible success for the company and delivered a dividend every year. Thanks for joining us, Lindsay.
It's great to be with you.
So give us a quick overview of Brickworks to people who might be new to the story.
Well, as you said, in 1934, the company was formed. Actually, there was a bunch of the Sydney brickmakers got together to buy out the state brickworks out of manufacturing bricks, which was at Homebush Bay, which ended up becoming the site of the Olympics. The government changed and the ownership of it changed a few times, and it went on its own way. But not long after that, they folded a number of the companies that had joined together to form Brickworks. They folded them in, and in amongst that was the Austral Brick Company, which had formed in 1908. And that was really the beginning of the story. I think we were on the New South Wales Exchange, but in 61, we listed on the National Exchange. And in 1968, we're worried that London Brick was going to take us over, Brickworks being the largest brickmaker south of the equator. So they thought of a few strategies, and it was pretty common in those days to have cross shareholdings. And the company that was the exact same size as us, a market cap of about $26 million, was Washington H. Soul Pattinson. Now, they got together and they swapped 1 million shares each. And the paper said the next day, directors on drugs, shareholders get brickbats. Still got that clipping on my computer today. And they went on then to buy shares in each other, and that continued about 1990 when ASIC said enough's enough. And at that point, Soul's owned about 49% of Brickworks, and Brickworks owned 43% of Soul's. And it had been effective, and it was made illegal at that point of time, but it was grandfathered as far as that relationship. But what it meant was that building products is a very volatile business, and in difficult times, you know, we could still pay our dividend out of the dividends we received from Soul's. And then from about 1999, 2000, when I took over, we started really to grow, because at that point in time, we were only five plants in two states. And we took over Bristile in 2003, which made it national and made us number one brickmaker, number two rooftop producer. And then we expanded in various areas, masonry for a while, and then precast. We got into timber, hard mill timber, and we got out of that. And then eventually, you know, we realized we couldn't grow anymore in Australia, and we headed off to the United States buying the Glengarry Corporation on Thanksgiving 2018, and that's what got us into the US. But along that way, the other thing that sort of really emerged is that from about 2000 on, we always had this enormous land bank, which had been our clay reserves, and it had become surplus for what we needed. And so we started to fold it out, and the zoning was right, and we joined up with Goodman in about 2005, 2006, so we started this property trust, and that in itself today has grown enormously. So they're the major parts of the business: Building Products Australia, United States, investment in Soul Pattinson, and a large industrial property portfolio.
Brick seems to be a very basic kind of building product, but these days fashion and trends are really important to product development. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, when you think about it, most bricks get used in housing, and most bricks we sell today are face bricks. Wasn't always the way. I mean, really up until 2000, we used a lot of commons and structural work when buildings were built properly. So when someone thinks about buying a house, it's usually the female that makes the decision, and it's all about the fashion. You know, what does the house look like? You know, is it going to keep up with the neighbours, and you know, how's it going to look, and how's it going to fit in the longer term? And so it's a really big decision. It's mostly the biggest fashion decision that you know, a family will make. And so we got a lot of trouble there to try and make sure A, we're up with the fashions, and B, we're able to help our clients in determining, you know, what the look of that house. And we do a lot of colour consultings and things, so that we get, you know, the whole external look of the house looking as best as it can for our customers.
And Lindsay, you mentioned, you know, the building products being a volatile business, and it's very tied to, you know, where we are in the property market right now. And, you know, I've seen various forecasts for the property market, you know, next year, immigration reopens, you know, the government by and large still committed to a big Australia policy. Both sides of the house still committed to a kind of a big Australia policy. So where do you think we are in the kind of property cycle right now for somebody who has been at the very pointy end of, you know, the cycle, both the highs and the lows over your career?
Yeah, sometimes I wish I wasn't at the pointy end, but that's where we find ourselves. But look, the demand is very strong at the moment. As you mentioned, the government stimulus have kicked things along. Interest rates are at record low levels. There's quite a bit of pent-up demand. I mean, the amount of demand there is really depends on what the price for housing is. And of course, you know, with low interest rates, that's gone up, and that might taper things a bit. The biggest issue going forward, of course, is the fact that we haven't really had any immigration for 18 months or more. And, you know, while our best estimate says it takes about 3 to as much as 8 years for somebody who migrates to the country to buy their first home or build their first house, that there's a bit of a pipeline there that's still in front of us. But of course, it won't hold forever. If immigration stays low or non-existent and internal birth rates remain incredibly low, then eventually, you know, we'll have enough housing. We'll catch up. But I guess to a certain degree, a lot of people aren't really concerned at the moment. It's good that we get a bit of a catch up. You know, we've had big immigration for over a decade, ever since the GFC. So I guess a lot of people are quite happy for us to sort of have an opportunity to catch up.
If we take a little bit of a deeper look at the US business, I mean, as you say, you're the number one in Australia. What was kind of the idea of going to the US as opposed to, you know, going across the Tasman, or, you know, moving into the UK, where, you know, there's a long history also of brick buildings? You only have to think of the Coronation Street intro to conjure up what most of Northern England looks like. But why did the US over maybe some markets closer to home, or kind of more traditional brick markets?
Yes, well, we did an evaluation. As I said, we couldn't really grow in Australia, and we already exported to New Zealand. It's not a very big market, and there's no major producers there anymore. And we really evaluated it, and we just came to the conclusion that the proposition to move to America, particularly under President Trump, you know, you couldn't beat it. The tax situation was excellent. It was a big business, over 40 manufacturers. There was lots of opportunities to get an entrance. And as it turned out, Ibstock, which of course is one of the two major UK producers, you know, wanted to sell Glengarry but didn't want to sell to Wienerberger, who owns General Shale in the United States, because they also compete with Wienerberger in the UK. So the fact that we came along was, you know, brilliant. We were always going to get Glengarry. And then from there, we've been able to expand. And, you know, energy prices, you know, abundant energy, about 30% of the cost of what it costs us for gas in Australia, excellent tax, you know, cheap, abundant labour. It was fairly abundant at that point of time. Anyhow, abundant labour, educated workforce, same language, you know, similar sort of laws. I had worked there before about 30 or 40 years ago, so I was familiar with it. I was familiar with a lot of the manufacturers. And so it was, you know, really quite an easy step for us to make to go to the US, other than the time change, which runs about usually about 10 or 11 hours. So it's quite difficult from a management point of view to talk to the staff over there. But other than that, it's been very good.
Lindsay, you've noticed some cost pressures in the US now. Things have changed with the current administration. And how is Brickworks dealing with that?
Well, some of the same themes we've seen emerge here. I mean, the first one is, of course, we have labour shortages in both countries, and we were pretty tight over there in some of the areas we're in. Unemployment was less than 2% prior to the pandemic. But, of course, now we've had this incredible rethink, and I think they're calling it the Great Resignation at the moment. People are reevaluating their lives, and the same trends there, as I said here, you know, people say, well, I don't want to live here anymore, I want to live somewhere else, or I think I can get myself a better job, or I don't like this company, I'll resign. And so this has created an enormous amount of turmoil. And of course, we're on the back end of the baby boomers. When people forget this, that the baby boomers are in full retirement mode now. And of course, a lot of them have decided, well, I'll just retire. And so we have a very tight labor market, and that's pushed up wages. And, you know, we're running at about 5 to 7% of our workforce. We're short at all times, which is about 50 to 70 people. And so that's made it difficult. Gas has firmed a bit, but we've got long-term gas contracts out 7 years, so not so worried about that. The biggest one that's had a direct impact is trucking. Because of the shortage of labour, there's a shortage of trucks. Cost of trucks, you know, shipping from, you know, point A to B, in some cases, you know, more than doubled. And in a lot of cases, we can't lift our full dispatch because we just can't field enough trucks. So that's most probably the greatest single impact is the lack of trucking and followed by lack of staff to run our plants.
Is there any scope to pass these higher costs on to consumers?
Yes, well, we've had some pretty solid price rises and we'll continue with that because it's a very competitive market. You can't get too far in front of your competitors. And I guess a lot of other participants in the market look to us as one of the leaders, particularly in the Midwest and the Northeast. And we've found, you know, as we move our prices, they sort of follow along. But yeah, look, it's absolutely necessary. You stay in front of that curve. If you get behind it, it's very hard to catch up and obviously would result in reduced margins.
And in terms of the Australian business, if we just come back to that, I know there's been a big CapEx program and a new plant upgrading program that are coming to an end, let's say, the end of calendar year 22. What's that going to mean in terms of, I guess, costs, margins, efficiencies? And then does that free up capital to be redirected back into dividends or to, you know, doing a similar kind of program with the US business?
Well, when we kicked off on a couple of the construction projects we had here, one was a replacement plant for a site that we had to get off that we never owned. But as it's progressed, there's two other sort of fundamental things that are sort of distorting what we'd like to do. And they are the fact that the industrial property, the land for industrial property is so valuable, it's accelerating the necessity to retire plants that we would have otherwise kept going is the first thing that's impacting us. And the second thing is, you know, there's an enormous push towards sustainability and reducing your carbon footprint. And this is sort of putting pressure on us to accelerate our program to modernise some of our plants that need modernising. So I think the high CapEx is going to continue for a number of years, driven by that. And then on top of that, we've also got the objective that there's new products that we want to get into that we don't currently manufacture. And we see good business opportunities in a number of areas. So I think the CapEx is going to stay up for a while. We haven't, you know, exactly retired the plants in the order we'd like for the reasons I just stated. So, you know, it's just part of growing the business. We're going through an enormous growth period. And where you'll see the value emerge from that is in the value of the industrial property trust. That's where it comes out. You know, our cash goes in to build a new plant. We get off a site, we demolish the old plant, and, you know, and then we do a pre-lease and build some sheds. And that's where the value emerges. So, you know, effectively our cash flow in the building products is going to create the value of the property trust.
Yeah, let's change gears a bit and talk about the property trust. I mean, it's been an enormous success over the last 15 years. I mean, in terms of recycling the capital, you know, it's great when you can sell land at these, you know, high prices because, as you say, it's one part of the property market that's, you know, really been on fire, and particularly the last 2 years. But in terms of, you know, finding recycling capital, selling off things, doing new things within the property trust, is it getting harder to, you know, make the numbers kind of stack up the way you want to?
No, not really. We're really a bit overwhelmed. I mean, we were running at about, you know, for years, about 30 to 50,000 square meters of lettable area per year. We're now running, you know, 250,000 meters per annum. And so we're running at an unprecedented level. And the projects stack up very easy, particularly with the low interest rates. And, you know, for us, effectively, you know, we're getting half of these completed buildings for just putting in the land. And so the cash actually doesn't go in there, as I was saying before. It goes in across to the building product side. But we've got, at the moment, end value of north of $1.2 billion will come through. And, you know, that'll increase in the next 2 years and increase our gross rent by $50 million just in the next 2 years. So it's got an enormous head of steam up. And, you know, hopefully in another couple of weeks, we're going to announce the completion of the PC of the Amazon building, which is the biggest warehouse in Australia. You know, it's north of 200,000 square meters in total floor area. You know, some incredible number of football fields, like 50. You know, these are massive, massive projects that we've had to deliver in conjunction with Goodman and our construction companies. But, you know, Australia hasn't seen, you know, developments like this previously.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because it seems to be that warehousing for these internet-style delivery companies is the big growth driver for industrial property. Is that what you're seeing? Is that the case for you?
Well, there's two things. That point you make is correct. But the second part is this, is that in amongst the supermarket chains, you know, there's an enormous amount of competition to get their warehousing and distribution as efficient as possible, you know, even beyond the click and connect. So they're automating them. And you know, this is the story of, you know, if Coles automates, well, Woolies has got to automate. And if Woolies automates, well, Aldi's got to automate. And so they need a different style of building. And they're high bay, they're 10 stories high, they can have a ground footprint between 50 and 70,000 square meters. And inside, they could have one of a couple of different systems. They have like an automatic racking system where a controlled, I don't know what you call them, a racking retrieve, you know, the retrieve pallets, et cetera.
A rack robot.
Fact, yeah. I don't really know what you call those. It's a bit like the ones in Amazon. Amazon run a different thing. They have this little like robot pod with a stillage on it and with, you know, 100 little pockets in it. And the items can be anywhere and it just sort of works it all out. But they're all different. They're specialized buildings. But the thing about them for us, which makes them so attractive, is that the value is about double the value of a traditional single-story cross-docking warehouse, first point. And second thing, to build these, we get very long leases. We usually sign a 20-year lease. And they're sticky because, you know, the amount of equipment they've got inside can be worth more than the building. So once they've invested that, they don't want to walk away from it. So you know you've got a blue chip, long-term tenant. So they're excellent as far as the investment point of view.
And there's also the challenge as well of finding that sweet spot logistically, isn't it, with the road, rail, ports and so forth.
Yeah, you've got to have the land. I mean, when we're doing a few of these, the bigger ones, I mean, they're only competing against one or two other blocks of land in the Sydney Basin, you know, because it's just companies don't have that big parcels of land like we have, you know.
And Lindsay, you know, given the footprint that you've got in the US, is there a possibility of kicking a similar thing off in the US, you know, trying to optimize that footprint of various plants in the Midwest and Northeast, maybe with Goodman or with a US partner who'd, you know, be similar to Goodman? Is that a possibility?
Well, initially we thought, you know, maybe not because the value of land is a lot less. But as we're sort of, you know, got to know the areas we're working, we sort of think that there's one or two sites that may have potential. Most of our factories in the US are sitting on about 500 or 600 acres of land, and so they're quite big. And some of them feed roads into major freeways. Like we've got one in the Mid-Atlantic area that feed a road to the freeway, which runs from Washington, D.C. to New York. And so obviously that's a major freeway. And you know, so that's maybe there's some potential there. And there's a Goodman building about 500 metres down the road. But they don't do the same over there as we do it here. You know, we do pre-leases, and so we build specifically. They tend to do more speculative work. But yeah, so yeah, we're looking at it. I think there is some potential. As we've been consolidating our plants, we've been also been peeling off land and the quarries, and that's just gone quite well. We've made a steady stream of profits, and I think that'll continue for a while, just that, you know, consolidating our footprint into a more efficient sort of format.
And the US business, as you mentioned, you're kind of in the Midwest and Northeast. Is that the kind of two markets you want to stay in, or is there a plan to, you know, push into the Southeast, over to the West Coast, and, you know, have a national footprint like you have in Australia? Obviously, when I say a national footprint, I'm talking multiple X's of size, but do you foresee, if we look out 10 years, that you would have a pretty much national footprint, or are the two markets, you know, because they're big population centers, the Midwest, you know, anchored by Chicago in the Midwest, and then you've got New York, Boston, Washington up in the Northeast. Are you going to stick to those? Because that's where, I guess, the vast majority of the US population live.
Well, each of these markets are slightly different. There's not a lot of bricks used on the West Coast. It's mainly like stucco and stuff. But in the areas that we work, they're traditional brick areas. And so there's a lot of brick being used in you know, 20 and 30 story apartment buildings, particularly in New York. And the repair and maintenance of those is a really important part, because it's got to be used the same bricks. For example, we're repairing the Chrysler building at the moment. We supplied the Chrysler building in the early 30s from our Hanley plant in Pennsylvania, and we're supplying the bricks from the same plant to do the maintenance on it. And so that's very good work. It's a premium price. And the architectural work we get in those areas, we do a lot of schools. Average school is about 1 million bricks, and we'd have 10 or a dozen underway at any one time. We do the big chains, the food chains, you know, all those sorts of things. We get a lot of that. Hospitals, you know, fire stations, and on it goes. And that's all high value, high specification work. In the southern states, like Texas, heading east across to the Carolinas, bricks are used predominantly in housing. And so it's very much like Australia, but it's big volume, lower prices. You can have big low-cost plants to compete in that. So it's a little bit different. But to get to the crux of your question, look, as I think opportunities come up and they're presented to us, there's no doubt we'll expand outside this footprint or intensify, you know, where we are. You know, we're already pretty dominant in the region that we're in, but there's no doubt we'll intensify that and dig in a bit deeper and become more entrenched. So I would think that over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, we'll mostly see a steady stream of acquisitions come through.
Lindsay, if I can get back to the trends and fashion sides of things in terms of brickwork, how does a company like Brickworks keep up with this? I mean, what's the shape of the department that looks after this and the team that looks after this?
Yeah, look, I think what I think is very close to architects. We have a great relationship with the architectural community in Australia, and we're building that relationship in the United States as well. And they're sort of usually across the trends, and you get a bit of a feel for it. We've got a number of suppliers. We actually import a lot of bricks, both into Australia and the United States, out of Italy and Spain. You know, and these companies are right across what the latest fashion trends are over there. So, and obviously, we keep pretty close to, there's companies that do the future colours, like called Colourways, and we stick very close to them. So we're always a few years out where we think things are going to go. And of course, what happened is that if you go back to late last century, you know, we used to have a lot of mottled bricks, and then we've gone through a period monochromatics, you know, monocolours. But now we've seen, since the pandemic, we've gone back into having mottles, and browns are back, and very rustic style, warm, rustic home style type products have come back in a big way as well. So, and you've got to be on top of that, and you've got to be able, you know, keep the products coming out that people want. And the fact that you're in the market, you get to know which ones are selling. If one particular style sells well, well, you obviously produce more of them. So,
just follow your nose.
Lindsay, if we just go back to the Soul Pats shareholding, you know, it's been a long cross shareholding. It's pretty unique, as you say. It was, you know, grandfather back in the 90s, so we haven't seen the setup, I guess, evolve over time. But in terms of that cross shareholding, do you think, you know, Brickworks would be where it is today without it?
Look, it's a good question. You could look at that a couple of ways. You know, you could have maybe argued that maybe Brickworks would even be bigger without it, you know, through doing equity raisings and things, which, of course, for a long time we were limited at. But a lot of companies have done equity raising and they haven't necessarily increased the value for their shareholders. And, you know, the discipline I'm paid to increase the wealth of my shareholders. And the last thing you want to do is raise equity because that dilutes them. So maybe that was a good discipline. But, of course, what's happened more recently, if you look over the last 20 years, a few shares went out here and there, and that 49% they owned of us has dropped to 43%. And more recently, and we sold some shares to prove to people they were real. It wasn't ghost equity, as some people spoke about. They had a high price at the time. We sold some. It suited us. It paid for the Glengarry acquisition effectively. And that brought us down to 39% of them. And then, of course, in the last few months, Souls has taken over Milton and did it as a scrip basis. And that was a $3 billion takeover. So we were actually diluted down to 26.1%. And so we're very much normal companies now. What that's done is that effectively the restrictions that were placed on us because of the cross-shareholding have now been removed. And, you know, if we wanted to buy back stock or issue shares or any of those other things, you know, we would be able to take those and Souls would be able to participate if they wanted. And, you know, very much now as a normal company. So I think it's a very positive thing. It also means that, you know, Souls is now worth north of $10 billion and, you know, we're the largest shareholder, so it's in a very strong position for us. And that's given them greater diversity of investments and I think given them greater opportunities to continue their very strong growth performance, which has been pretty similar to ours. I mean, both companies have grown at about 13% compound for, you know, north of 50 years. And I don't think there's really very few companies on the stock exchange that can claim that.
I think the benefit of Souls as well, you talked about Brickworks' long dividend history. I mean, Souls also has a long dividend history in it. When you're in a business like building products, as we mentioned, you know, being at the pointy end of the property cycles, it's great to have that stabilizing income coming through when sometimes is most needed to just kind of give a bit of stability to an otherwise, you know, very volatile industry just by nature.
Yes, yeah, so look, that's right. And if I look at it today, you know, 75% of our assets are investments, about half in Soul Pats and about a quarter in the property trust. So there's only a quarter of our investment is in actual building products. Basically, everything we get as income from Soul Pats or from our property trust, we pay out as a dividend. And that's why I can be very confident that, you know, we'll be able to pay the dividend next year and the dividend will go up. And there's very few companies that can say that. And that's irrespective of whatever goes on, because, you know, that money is virtually guaranteed. It's not like we've got to have any earnings, or, you know, trading conditions won't affect us. You know, we'll be able to deliver that.
Lindsay Partridge, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today. It's a great company, and we follow it with great interest. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Lindsay. It was good to hear the story firsthand again.
Companies interviewed for this podcast have contributed to the cost of production. This should not be construed as sponsorship or endorsement. The role of this podcast is to convey the company's story. All listeners must seek advice from an ASIC-licensed finance professional before making any investment in these companies. Listeners are required to do their own research and due diligence in conjunction with the relevant advice from your ASIC-licensed finance professional. Participation by companies in the podcast does not suggest or imply any sort of recommendation about the companies being interviewed. Nothing in the podcast is to be considered general or personal financial advice in any way, shape, or form. All company interviews are for informational and educational purposes only.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.